Welcome to Obesity, a Disease, the official Obesity Medicine Association podcast exploring the many facets of the disease of obesity. In this episode, obesity medicine specialist and OMA clinical education director, Dr. Nicholas Pennings interviews Dr. Andres Acosta, a highlighted speaker from Obesity Medicine 2021 virtual conference, about precision therapy for obesity. Obesity, a Disease podcast is brought to you by the Obesity Medicine Association, the clinical leaders in obesity medicine.
Weight loss testimonials are common. Celebrities and other individuals touting 30, 50, or even 100-pound weight loss with a specific intervention. The implication is, if it works for me, it can work for you too. We would all love a single solution to solve the obesity epidemic, but as our understanding of obesity deepens, so too is the recognition that there's widespread variability in how anyone responds to a weight loss intervention, whether it be dietary, behavioral, physical activity, medication, or surgery. There are responders and non-responders. Ideally, we would all like to deliver interventions that are tailored to meet the needs of a person's unique psychology and physiology. Hi, I'm Dr. Nick Pennings, Chair of Family Medicine at the Campbell University School of Osteopathic Medicine and Executive Director of Clinical Education at the Obesity Medicine Association. And I have with me today Dr. Andres Acosta, obesity medicine researcher and assistant professor at the Mayo Clinic, who is advancing strategies to provide precision therapy to individuals with obesity. Dr. Acosta presented at the 2021 OMA Spring Virtual Conference, delivering a lecture titled Precision Medicine for Obesity. Welcome, Dr. Acosta.
Thank you so much, Dr. Pennings. It's a real honor to be here with you.
Thank you. Your specialty is gastroenterology, but your approach to obesity is much broader than the GI system. A particularly intriguing area of your research is on individualizing obesity therapy. How did you come to make that a focus of your research?
Yeah, that's a beautiful question, a nice way to start to our work. As a gastroenterologist, I'm still working on that. Quite curious about trying to understand food intake and those cues that tells our brain to feel full or when to feel hungry, and that interaction between our brain and our gut. We gastroenterologists like to call it the gut sending the signals to the brain. But then when I started studying the complexity of obesity during my PhD work and then subsequently during my postdoc work, I immediately realized that as I was talking with patients and I was doing the research, obesity cannot be studied in silos. You know, I only study the gut, you only study the brain, and so on and so on. We need to have a comprehensive approach to obesity because our patients don't come with, I'm going to see a gastroenterologist because I have a gut problem. Our patients with obesity, they have a comprehensive disease, very complex, very heterogeneous, that we need to combine everything and anything that we can to study the complexity of obesity. No, we think the gut plays a very important role, but it's not more important than the adipose tissue or the brain or our behavior, all these other things that matter a lot when we talk about obesity. So as a gastroenterologist who started thinking about connections between the gut and the brain and food intake, now I feel that our work needs to be comprehensive and we need to study all the variables that matter in patients. And whenever we start seeing things that really matter and can help our patients and how we change their management, we incorporate our research. Following a little bit of the Mayo model of the, you know, the patient's interest is the only interest we should care, is the same thing with obesity. If something might change the outcome of our patient, we should study it, we should incorporate it to our research, and then hopefully bring it back to our patients and help them with their management of this very difficult disease.
Yes, I think as we all delve into our understanding of obesity, we recognize that it is complicated and there isn't a single solution to this. Mm-hmm. And at the conference, you spoke about how in your research, you come to identify four different obesity phenotypes. What are those phenotypes? And does each individual fall into one category or is there overlap?
Once we start studying all these different variables, initially in 2015, using machine learning models and using clustering disease and principal component analysis, the machine told us that we can maybe subclassify obesity in about 11 variables. And then with my then mentor, I was doing my postdoc then, and now colleague Michael Camilleri, At Mayo Clinic, we decided to start looking into these variables that were subclassified into different groups of obesity. And we say, well, how can we group these groups that were told us from a black box of machine learning? And we start looking that the patterns were basically breaking down into four. And in order to come to these new four classifications, we study 450 patients at Mayo. And as I was just mentioning before, we did a very comprehensive study of obesity and energy intake and energy expenditure, thinking that those are the two main components that are contributing to our energy balance and our disbalance or lack of balance that actually drives to our obesity. So using and measuring all these variables in 450 patients, we came to four main types of obesity. The first group of obesity is what we call hungry brain. And the reason why we call it hungry brain is because patients have an abnormal sensation of satiation, our sensation of fullness. So when we eat, the signals from the gut, or especially the distension of our stomach, needs to send a signal to the brain through the vagus nerve as well as through hormones and tell our brain, I feel full, I should stop eating. Unfortunately, these type of patients with obesity, they usually go for seconds and thirds. And when we measure how many calories they eat in an ad libitum buffet meal, these patients are eating about 600 calories more than the average patient with obesity. So that's the first group, hungry brain. The second group is what we call hungry gut. They have abnormal postprandial satiety. And you might say, why hungry brain, hungry gut? Talking about satiation and satiety, most of experts like myself, we get them wrong. Satiation and satiety terms are very close to each other. So we decided to walk away from them. And the first group we call hungry brain, satiation. The second group we call hungry gut, satiety. So what is hungry gut? It's when a patient eats, they feel full with a normal amount of calories. Within an hour or two, they start feeling hungry again. Why is this happening? The gut is emptying their stomach too fast. That should create signals that come from our gut to our brain, such as GLP-1, PYY, CCK, and other hormones, gastrointestinal hormones that induce satiety, to tell the brain to keep staying feeling full. So that fullness that you reach when you stop should last for a longer period of time. And unfortunately, these patients, they don't get those signals and they feel hungry sooner. Those signals are very important in a normal individual because we need time to digest our food. But unfortunately, these patients, unfortunately, those signals are not working appropriately. And that's what we call them, the hungry gut. The third group is something that most of us in obesity might feel more familiar with, which is emotional hunger. It's relatively easier to identify. Patients are eating for stress, for emotions, to cope with life. And I like to joke that these are patients who are eating for positive emotions or negative emotions. When they have a good day, they seek food. Then when they have a bad day, they seek food to cope with life. And the fourth group is patients who have an abnormal metabolism. They have abnormal energy expenditure. So when we measure the resting energy expenditure, and we predicted either against Harris Benedict, as we just showed at the meeting last weekend, or we use fat-free mass, this data not published, these patients have lower than predicted energy expenditure when we measure the indirect calorimetry. And we call them a slow burn because they're just not burning enough calories. So if every day you're burning 10% or less, that means that every day you're saving 10% more calories that you will be burning. So those are the main four groups of obesity. Using these four groups of obesity in these 450 patients, we can explain that 85% of patients will meet one of these groups, telling us that 15% of patients do not have any of these four phenotypes. Additionally, when we look at these 85% of patients, 27% of them will have more than one phenotype, two or more phenotypes. And that is important because that just tells you about the complexity of obesity, as we were talking about at the beginning, that despite of we trying to narrow down and bring it up to these unique subgroups of obesity, there's still individuals who have more than one phenotype. And it's important to study them further and manage them appropriately, as we have proposed.
And it's interesting, as you go through each one of those phenotypes, I can think of patients in my practice that fit into each one of those categories. And so that's very interesting. And then based on that, you've also then tailored therapies around those each phenotypes. Do you want to explain a little bit about how you would tailor therapy according to those different phenotypes?
absolutely. But first, I wanna acknowledge your comment, because we have studied this, and in a very careful and detailed way, we have using validated measurements to measure these different variables. But every time that I talk with an obesity expert, such as yourself, Dr. Pennings, it's what we are asking our patients and what we're trying to figure out. And sometimes the phenotype jumps right out to us. Sometimes it's a little bit more difficult. But over and over, I'm hearing from my colleagues and the other obesity expert and ABOM certified physicians and providers who are telling me, you know, some patients, it's very easy to identify this, and it is. And we are trying to ask this question to our patients. So we're trying to make it just a little bit more objective for the matter of what you just said. And that's a perfect segue, because why we care about these obesity phenotypes? Why do we care if a patient has one phenotype versus the other? And the most exciting thing is because we have published already 9 publications. 4 of them are randomized placebo-controlled trials. 3 more of them are retrospective studies using post hoc analysis of large trials, particularly with endoscopic devices. And now we have 2 studies which are real world evidence pragmatic trials. And what it comes down to is that with all this evidence, particularly from the randomized trials, we have come out with this working hypothesis that is what we just published in the paper in obesity. So if you have a hungry brain, abnormal satiation, we recommend that you do a hungry brain diet. The medication to use that is approved right now by the FDA is phentermine topiramate extended release. The device should be something than the endoscopic sleeve gastroplasty or the vagal V block, and the surgical procedure is the laparoscopic sleeve. If you have a hungry gut diet, we recommend the hungry gut phenotype. We recommend a hungry gut diet. The medications are the GLP-1s, particularly liraglutide 3 milligrams, which is approved by the FDA for obesity. The device should be intragastric balloons or intragastric gels. And then the surgical intervention should be Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. And again, that's a working hypothesis. For if you have an emotional hunger, we highly recommend an emotional hunger diet with cognitive behavioral therapy. And then bupropion naltrexone should be the medication of choice. And for the slow burn, we recommend resistance training combined with a cardiovascular program for activity with a slow burn diet, and maybe using phentermine more than as an appetite suppressant, but more as a sympathomimetic to stimulate the metabolism of our patients. And that's the working hypothesis we have. Sorry.
And this morning, I saw a patient who seemed to be doing all the right things and making progress, but finding it challenging. And I've put her on phentermine, and she's been making some progress. But we did do a metabolic analysis on her, and she was burning 300 fewer calories a day than predicted by her Harris-Benedict equation. Mm-hmm. And so we had a long talk about physical activity this morning. So thank you for that. And it helped me with that particular patient.
Yeah.
So how do these phenotypes evolve? Are they the result of obesity, or are they the cause of obesity?
To me, that's right now the $1 million question. Is it a chicken or the egg? And it's a great question, right? Do we have obesity because we are born, or we have this phenotype that is driving us that equation? Or because we get obesity for other reasons, then we have these phenotypes, which is making us difficulty more to, or making the lost weight or the losing weight more difficult. So I don't know. I don't know the answer. But here I have a few things or a few thoughts that comes to my mind when I hear these questions. The first one is, if we look at a genetic predisposition for obesity and patients who have genetic mutations, for example, patients with the melanocortin 4 pathway abnormalities, or a leptin receptor abnormality, we know that those patients have hyperphagia since they were born. And then develop childhood obesity, age 3-4, they already have obesity, and they continue to have severe obesity throughout their lives. So in that case, it's very easy to say, well, the patient was born with a genetic mutation, early childhood obesity, they have obesity the rest of their life because of this. And we see that their phenotype is this hyperphagia, which I think is hungry brain, but that needs to be proven. Now, at the same time, you know, fast forward, we just did a study that was published last year in International Journal of Obesity, in which we took young adults patients with obesity younger than 35 years old, who had a rapid gastric emptying, which we're defining hungry gut. So abnormal postprandial satiety, rapid gastric emptying, and already obesity, despite of being young, younger than 35 years old. And we followed them for 5 years, and we saw that those who had a rapid gastric emptying and abnormal postprandial satiety, again, hungry gut, gained more weight than the controls who did not have that phenotype. So that suggests that maybe these particular observations might be carrying out for you to gain more weight and might be your driver for disease. Now, let's explain this in more simple terms. If you don't feel full because you have a genetic mutation with the first example, you're likely going to eat more calories. So you're going to come to the table, you order a large pizza, you're going to eat a lot more calories than someone who does not have the genetic mutation. And if you need more calories in every meal before you feel full, likely you're going to gain weight. On the other example, if you have a hungry gut and you are a young adult, you will eat your normal meals. But if you feel hungry an hour or two later, you're going to eat more calories. And you're going to be constantly eating more calories than your peers. So while my answer is chicken or the egg question, I tend to believe that phenotypes might be driving our behaviors, whether in food intake or expenditure. And that might be maybe a reason why we're gaining weight, and also might be the reason why we should tackle them and treat them as we're treating obesity.
So the egg doesn't exist without the chicken, and the chicken doesn't exist without the egg. And so I see that, you know, as people have a genetic propensity to develop obesity and are placed in an obesogenic environment, and they're going to gain weight. But then also those who develop obesity have physiologic changes that prevent weight loss and mm-hmm. help protect that weight gain. And so perhaps it is a bit of both that are involved.
Yeah. And actually, I should explain a little bit more of the, maybe I talk more about the egg, but not of the chicken. So if we look at the other side, if we have a patient who's eating, who has, you know, weighs 300 pounds, maybe they need more calories. We know by, you know, doing things like direct calorimetry, we know they need more calories to maintain their weight. So if the set point of those patients have adjusted and now they need more calories to go with their daily lives, are those people who are heavier going to consume more calories because they have a hungry brain or because they just need more calories to survive? Going back to the example of the gut, we know that increased abdominal adiposity may affect your gastric emptying. If you have more fat within your belly, that might reduce your gastric emptying and your capacity and send the signals, and your gastric emptying might be faster. At the same time, you have less gastrointestinal hormones like GLP-1 and PYY. So the question is, which one comes first? And that's why I think, just to close this, physiological underminings of obesity, either the chicken or the egg, that these phenotypes are affecting you. And I think we need to do a lot more research to understand, particularly on those patients who do not have a genetic mutation, who are just more the outcome of the environment. And that's why I like to call this about phenotypes, because we have the genetics on one side and the environment on the other. And when we combine both, we get our phenotype. And I think that will help us understand if it's the chicken or the egg of obesity.
And so perhaps more than an either or, it's a vicious cycle that is created.
Yeah.
Okay. So you have a rather extensive process for identifying individual phenotypes, utilizing multiple questionnaires, gastric emptying, metabolic analysis, and activity tracking. How might providers who are treating obesity in the clinical setting better identify phenotypes and customize their treatment of the patient with obesity?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I know that our testing is limited to a few academic centers. I know that other centers who are doing more advanced obesity might have one thing or the other. So I have a short answer or a short-term answer and then a more long-term answer. So I think right now in the short term, we should try to see within our facilities what we have available. For example, you were measuring that you measure indirect calorimetry, and that's great. And many facilities have already adopted the use of indirect calorimetry in their practices. So I will say use it in these kind of regards, and let's try to build more data around that. If we don't have those resources, I think it's great to spend some time talking with our patients about these potential phenotypes, because in questioning, I get it right about 50% of the times. So it's not ideal, but it's good. It's good. It's a good way of trying to start the conversation. And that's, I think, we should do in the long term. I, at the same time, I want to take the opportunity to share what we're doing at Mayo Clinic, is we're trying to develop a biomarker that will help us predict these obesity phenotypes, so people don't have to go and do all these measurements. The biomarker will be a simple fasting blood test, something hopefully as simple as the hemoglobin A1C or the lipid panel, that eventually a physician can order and help guide the treatment for our patients. This is still in development, but we hope that it will be available in the near future.
Well, that sounds very interesting and exciting. So I like Yogi Berra quotes, and one of my favorite quotes is, it's tough to make predictions, especially about the future. yeah. But I'm going to ask you to dust off your crystal ball and tell us, what role do you see precision medicine for obesity playing in future patient care?
Well, as it's difficult to predict the future, as your quote says, when we talk about the future, you know, I can dream. And my dream is that in the future, we have very targeted and precision medicine approach, that a patient can come to an expert like us, ask for care of obesity, and when they're ready to lose weight, they get in a healthy weight loss pattern that they're 100% successful. Because we know that not everyone wants to lose weight, but we also know that many people are trying to lose weight and failing. But when they're ready, they see an expert like us, they will be successful. So how do we achieve success? I think we need to bring science with evidence. And I hope that our phenotype approach, and not only the four phenotypes, there might be more, there might be less, but a phenotype approach helps us stratify patients. So we can very easily put our patients in different buckets. And then from those buckets, we have enough tools. I love what Dr. Craig Pregman said on his introductory talk at OMA about the toolbox and the five tools that he has to pay help for his patients. Then we can have specific tools for each of our patients. And our patients at the end of the year, 2 years, or whatever time it takes them, they get to a successful weight, healthy weight, and then they keep that weight off. And I really want to say that this has to be paired with a physician and a provider, not only physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs, and so on, all the providers who are in the space of obesity. Because we need to bring the precision medicine approach that we have been using for many diseases, that we stratify diseases based on unique characteristics. For example, systolic heart failure versus dystolic heart failure. We don't talk about just heart failure. We put last names to diseases. So I think in obesity, we should start putting a last name. We should start putting a label. And then us, as providers, we can actually do the art of medicine, which is basically what many people call personalization. And many people say I have a personalized approach. That's what we do in the art of medicine. I have Mr. Smith, that I think that Mr. Smith has obesity with a hungry gut. And I'm going to provide this medication, for example, liraglutide. But I realize that this patient has a contraindication for this medication. So maybe I need to know those things that a precision medicine approach will never tell me. And then once I can see that, I can actually go and find what is my second option that only the provider in a very personalized approach will understand. And we can keep going with examples like this, but that would be my dream. And my dream will finish that we can have obesity being as successful as something like managing lipids. Dr. Penis, you may remember when we were managing lipids before the statins, and when we were managing lipids before LDL, HDL, and triglycerides, we were just talking about total cholesterol. And we did not have a true guide on how to manage our patients. And now when my patient comes to my office, says, hey, doc, I just saw my results. Seems like my LDL is high. What can we do for that? Or seems like my good cholesterol is low. I need to bring it up. So that kind of knowledge and discussion makes managing a disease way easier. And I hope that we, in obesity, we can have something similar in which we can have these buckets, these phenotypes, that then a provider can actually use that information, educate the patient, select the right page, the right tool, and the patient will be successful. And the patient language, conversation, stigma, and all those negative things that we see with obesity will change, and we will be able to address the disease and help the more than 1 billion people suffering with this worldwide.
And I agree, that would be a tremendous help to physicians. It would also be a help to patients, because many patients struggle with weight loss and they don't understand why. And giving them an understanding and an insight as to why their struggles are. Like I had talked to this patient this morning, that it's going to be more difficult for her to lose weight because her metabolism is slower than predicted. And that provides, while a frustration, but also a comfort of knowing that it's not just all in my head and it's not just all my fault. So I think that's important. So lastly, what is your favorite tip for providers who treat patients with obesity?
That's a great question. I think I like to say the most to my patients, and I share that with the fellows and with the residents when they come to my clinic, is that I think we need to share with our patients that we should be here for them for the good days and the bad days. And I don't think patients should see us as, oh, I'm going to try Dr. Penning's or I'm going to try Dr. Acosta, like they're labeling a commercial program for weight loss. They should come and see us. And if they're doing great, we want to know. If they're doing poorly, we want to know. And we have so many tools. And, you know, we should not get tired of having tools and help our patients. And right now in our practice of trial and error, that's what we do. And we tell the patients, keep coming back. We will get it. We will get it right. And hopefully in the future of precision medicine, we will get it right from the beginning, or we will get more patients right from the beginning. But I think it's important to tell our patients, hey, and I go through the extreme of something crazy like this, but I tell my patients, hey, if you have cancer and things are not working, you don't go and shop in the next store. You keep coming back to me. In obesity, I want you to keep coming back to me. And I want you to bother me if you are not losing weight, because I will be able to help you. I might just not get it right on the first time, but I'm going to help you.
I agree. I think that is a great message, because I always tell my patients my most important role is when you're struggling, not when you're succeeding. Yeah. So to make sure that you come in when you're having a hard time, and we always have a plan B. Right. Yeah, and absolutely. Always let him know that there's a plan B. Well, yeah. Dr. Acosta, it's been great talking with you. I really appreciate you coming and joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
You can see Dr. Acosta's presentation at the 2021 Spring Academy conference on the OMA Academy, which is found at obesitymedicine.org. How can our listeners learn more about your work?
Well, we're trying to publish as much as we can our work. But we're delighted to have come to OMA now a couple of times. And I think that's a great avenue to share our work. And otherwise, keep looking for the publications.
Yes, yeah, so some great recent publications. Yeah. Thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Drs. Pennings and Acosta. For more information about Obesity Medicine podcasts and other resources from the clinical leaders in obesity medicine, please visit www.obesitymedicine.org/podcasts. Loved the episode of Obesity, a Disease? Head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. The views expressed in this podcast episode are those of the show hosts and do not necessarily represent the opinions, beliefs, or policies of the Obesity Medicine Association or its members. Please check back in soon for another episode of Obesity, a Disease.